Flo, thanks so much for speaking with us today. Could you tell us a bit about the Great War for the uninformed? What is the channel looking to do for people?
The Great War was an ongoing documentary series, first of its kind, covering the events of World War I week by week, exactly 100 years later. So we started in late July 2014, which, well, I mean, for the Euro-Australians, the war started in August, but the spark that kind of lit the whole thing on fire was Austria-Hungary and Serbia going to war. That happened 28th of July, and that is when we published our first weekly episode. And from there on until, well, last Sunday, we covered the war week by week in basically real time.
Awesome. So what would you say the main benefits are of learning history in this real-time fashion?
I think the strength is twofold. So first of all, for someone who is not like a super history buff and doesn't want to watch a 90-minute history documentary, they probably are going to watch a 10-minute or a 12-minute bite-sized documentary once a week, like in their lunch break. The other aspect is that even though we only have these bite sizes, in the end, it's probably the most detailed documentary about World War I that has ever been produced. Like with all the other extra content we produced, I think we eclipsed something of 45 hours or something of content in the end. So it's bite-sized for the consumer, but on the other hand, it's also very, very detailed, and we can cover so much more relevant topics to this huge conflict that in most, you know, 90-minute documentaries on TV or anything don't get covered. And I think that also shaped a lot of the misconceptions about World War I in the first place.
Sure. So in terms of that particular format, how feasible do you think that would be for other areas of history, both before and after World War I?
I think there is like unlimited ways to explore this kind of format. I think the Great War had the advantage, or the First World War had the advantage, that it was the first war that also happened in mass media. So we had like millions of photos. There's hours of film reels that we used for the show and everything. From there, moving forward, there's countless conflicts where you can, you know, which are well documented in like archives in visual forms. So it's a visual medium, that's important, but also in terms of like written sources, newspapers, reports, that kind of thing. So that's kind of a prerequisite. I think in the end, you could also go back. I don't know, you could do like the American Civil War or 30 Years War or something like that. But then you really need to think about, if you want to do it in video form, then you need to think about how you visualize it. That being said, I think from a general approach, I think this real-time kind of format works very well. I think, I mean, there are some Twitter accounts, for example, out there that cover World War II in like real time. Like the tweet goes out at the same hour actually when an attack happened or something. And there's also podcasts that did the same thing for World War I that we did with our show. So this kind of approach, I think, works very, very well.
That's really cool. I'd never heard of the Twitter approach to that. So what would be some of the largest challenges that you guys went through in going through this enormous 4+ year program? Like, that's a huge undertaking. What were the biggest hurdles that you had to cross?
It was a huge undertaking, and from a you know, very broad perspective, 4.5 years in internet age is like 40 years basically. I mean, sometimes it feels like it because the, you know, in the online world is so super fast paced and everything. So it was kind of a gamble to say, to start a project that would last 4.5 years. And then, I mean, you know, if you only make it halfway, then it's basically worthless because you can't really advertise a documentary that covers half the war. You need to really pull through with it. It's, you know, for a YouTube channel, it was not only in the general scope of the length, it was pretty big, but also in terms of like the team size and everything. I mean, like, you know, we only always envision YouTube channels as this kind of like one man show, one creator, you can start and then you can ramp it up. And if it gets successful, you hire some people or anything. With the Great War, we were a team of 5-6 people from the start. That was our like day job. I mean, we didn't, you know, do this in our free time. We got paid for this. And so there's a high amount of investment and production that needs to be realized. And the only way we could do this was, luckily enough, that a lot of people appreciated what we did so far and supported us via donations. Otherwise, just from things like ad revenue on YouTube or something, we wouldn't have been able to do this. These are basically, like, I would say, the economic factors around it. If you go more into things like research and everything, you know, there's not a real detailed timeline already. So our host Indy had to, he basically had to develop this crazy method where he was reading like 3-4 books at the same time and basically writing 5 or 6 episodes in parallel to always fill in the gaps when certain dates were missing and to figure out what happened really on what front. Then you also very quickly realize that there is a huge focus and a huge body of work about the Western Front and, you know, maybe about things like Gallipoli, but, you know, if you go, for example, I mean, Eastern Europe was crazy. At one point, the Eastern Front was the longest continuous front line in world history up until that point, you know, reaching from the Baltic Sea all the way to the Black Sea. And it's super important and everything, but the coverage is much less detailed. And from there on, it gets, you know, more obscure. I mean, there's like fronts like the Senussi Front in Libya and, you know, the African theaters. It's called a world war for a reason. And, you know, it was definitely very challenging to give equal amount of time to all the theaters out there. We had to build this crazy production pipeline here to kind of get this going. I mean, you know, once in a while someone gets sick or you go on vacation, or we, you know, we did a lot of road trips, you know, filmed with museums and met with the fans and everything, and you still need to make sure that every Thursday that episode come out, and somehow we managed it. You know, all of us have backgrounds in production. Like we needed that kind of level of proficiency in producing and in the medium in the team to achieve any of that. I mean, we couldn't really start learning how to, you know, organize a shoot or anything just on the go. We already knew that and needed to apply that for this specific project.
Sure. So in this whole enormous stretch, as you said, there were, you know, some parts on the Eastern Front that weren't as well covered as the Western Front in Gallipoli and similar campaigns. Were there any like significant discoveries or new information that you guys found in working on the Great War?
We didn't really have the time or the resources to do like original research, like to go into archives for primary sources and everything. We mostly relied on secondary sources. That being said, I think for a lot of our viewers, there was a lot in the show that they didn't know about. Even people, people wrote to us in the YouTube comments and said, like, I thought I know a lot about the war, but I was obviously pretty wrong because I've never heard about the Central Powers campaign in Romania, the Senussi Front I mentioned, or things like what was going on in Persia. We did something about a secret mission, a secret German mission into Afghanistan. We covered Guam in the war. We covered the Pacific theater and everything. There was something, you know, for everybody who even was an expert in a certain aspect of the war, we showed him that there was even more out there that they could learn about. And I think from the viewing standpoint, that was the great realization for them, but also for all of us. I mean, World War One remembrance is not nearly as big in Germany as it is in Australia. And I mean, we know of the Western Front in Verdun, of course, and, you know, Tannenberg is also something that most people know here. But I had no idea about Romania, for example. I had no idea about the Caucasus theater. I had no idea about a lot of things, basically. And also, I mean, we are all history buffs, you know. We also thought we knew quite a lot about the war, but apparently we also didn't.
Yeah, as you say, yeah, you're a history buff, and I feel like every history buff has, you know, that one fact that they'll love to bring up. So of what the Great War covered, what's yours?
You know, since I'm a kid, I was always a sucker for, you know, technical aspects and machinery and everything, military machinery. And I really appreciated all the things that we did about the tanks and basically how this new kind of weapon got invented and everything. It was such a pleasure to film at different museums and everything. It was quite fascinating to learn about how horrible. I mean, you see these things from the outside; they're like beasts of steel. But learning, you know, through diaries how it was inside of these tanks and these machineries is like, that's something I tell people about, because it's very relatable, but on the other hand also unimaginable. I mean, like the early tank models basically had their exhaust pipes in the front, and the people would sit in the fumes for a few hours, and it's just this horrible, unimaginable experience, and this kind of clash of what was then modern machinery but also this perceived ideal of warfare and glory, you know, which was heavily displayed in propaganda, and everything. And I think this kind of like inside these kind of tank is like, it's like a microcosm of this clash of modernity and of the 20th and the 19th century inside these vehicles. You know, a lot of people also say that, yeah, I mean, these things look so unwieldy and they, you know, it's not really impressive. And you can see from the views on our YouTube channel that people are not as interested anymore in biplanes or, you know, a lot of these obscure looking tanks because, you know, it's just not as cool, in air quotes, as some of the maybe World War II tech or the modern military tech we have. But, you know, this was pinnacle technology at the pinnacle of technology at the time. A lot of people thought a lot about how these things could be built under time pressure, under resource pressure and everything. And it's such a good thing to study and to talk about. This is what World War One was like.
Yeah, it's always really interesting to see the amount of technological development that came out of the wars for all of the horrors that it is. You know, that's a lot of what pushed, especially after World War II, with all the rocketry technology, the space race and things like that.
Just to add, what I also find fascinating is like the whole medical development. Like when we were in Verdun in a museum, the guy there had a few arm prosthetics, and you see these, you know, steampunk-looking devices and everything, but medical technology made a huge leap forward in the war, partly because there were so many new kind of injuries as well, and the whole triage system, and also, you know, the aftermath with shell shock and disfigurements and amputations. Such an inhumane thing, but also very humane thing at the same time, because plastic surgery was basically invented in the war, or, you know, really got attention and as a field of study because it was necessary now. And that's also something that I like to talk about, though you have to say that, you know, if you want to look at pictures about this and everything, it's not for the lighthearted.
Yeah, I've grown up the son of a doctor, and every time I borrow his camera, I open it up and I'm like, oh, people's insides. So I've gotten used to that.
Okay, well then you can get the photos. I just described.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, you could see how people are responding to certain content based on the views and their responses in the comments and things. How much did having an active audience shape the content that you made?
I mean, the community aspect was built into this project from the very beginning. I mean, when I started, I was, you know, just the social media manager. I mean, I was pretty actively involved in the production from the beginning because we said from the beginning, there are so many history buffs out there, and we were pretty certain that there's people out there who, about a very obscure field of the war, will be, you know, experts and have knowledge that we never have. So the first thing that we did was starting to build a workflow in which feedback from the community and research from the community could be applied to the show. And I mean, this is directly visible in, if you look at our special episodes, you know, some of them wouldn't have been possible without the research by locals, for example, who speak some of the languages that we don't speak. But there's also tidbits in the weekly episodes that are based on fan research. Our maps that drastically improved because we got in contact with some people who do digital cartography, or also just by people pointing out, hey, this lake that you have on your modern map there, which is supposedly 1914, this thing didn't exist until 1970. So in that sense, this feedback loop from the community was very important. I think also getting in touch with, you know, people who said like, oh yeah, here's a photo of my grandfather, or hey, your project encouraged me to ask my parents or my grandparents or to look up my family history. And I found this photo, I found this story. I didn't know that my uncle fought in the war. And this kind of encouragement was also something that was, you know, a huge personal motivator to do this project. And in that sense, you know, since, you know, we have viewers from all over the world, I mean, we have a lot of Australians watching, but Canadians, Germans, French people, a lot of people in Scandinavia, a lot of people in Eastern Europe who watched the show. And in that sense, it was also kind of a digital global commemoration and remembrance project. And that was something that we were really proud about, and that we also wanted to foster over the length of the project. It has been, you know, also a great encouragement to see, you know, just when we published the last weekly episode on Sunday, some people said, hey, when I started watching this show, I was in high school, and now I just graduated from college and I'm starting to work in a few weeks. Or, you know, people spend a certain amount of their formative years, especially if they're younger, with our show and grew up with it. And that's such a cool thing and really motivating.
That's fantastic. So now that the main project is wrapped up, you've covered the war day by day for 4 and a bit years. What is the team at MediaCraft looking at moving on to now?
We thought about it a bit, what we want to do, and we was pretty sure pretty quickly that we want to keep doing serial historical documentaries, which we as a team behind the Great War will do in our own company starting next year. But, and I think that's important, we all celebrate Armistice Day on 11/11, but I mean, the war wasn't really over. There was still fighting going on in a lot of parts of the world. I don't know, the British blockade was still going on. All the soldiers had to go home. Peace terms had to be actually negotiated, peace contracts and that kind of thing. So we decided and we reached an agreement with MediaCraft about it, that we can actually continue publishing content on the show. We will move away a bit from the weekly format because this kind of period after the war, it's much more localized things that are not as interconnected as during the war. Also, it's much harder to research, you know, these kind of precise time frames. So we will be moving away from the weekly updates, but we will still stick in the timeline and we still want to tell people about the immediate aftermath of the war. Because, I mean, an armistice, and the 11/11 armistice was also just one of several armistices that were signed. An armistice is not just a peace switch. You know, it's not just societies going from fighting each other to embracing each other, and then they all live happily ever after. There is this kind of feeling, I think, across the societies. It's like the question is, was this all worth it? I mean, like, we sacrificed our lives, our health, we sacrificed our loved ones and everything. Was this all worth it now in the end? And there were huge expectations in 1919 to create this new world order, you know, after the 14 points of Wilson, but also with all the new countries emerging in Eastern Europe. And there was this huge expectation, I think, this now better be worth it. And this was super complicated. And it always also gets a bit left out in the official histories because of the 11/11 date. I mean, you know, such a date is it's very good for remembrance, but it's real history doesn't just, you know, it's not a switch flipped. It's like it creeps onwards and it's complicated and it's messy. And we want to kind of still continue publishing content on the Great War channel that tells this story as well, to give people an idea about what it actually means to create the League of Nations or what it actually means to negotiate the Treaty of Versailles. You know, time was always a very important aspect of the Great War, and a lot of people actually realize what it means that, you know, in history book it says the war lasted from 1914 to 1918, and that's like a sentence you can read in 2 seconds, but what actually 4.5 years of war, what that means, became very apparent to people who followed our show, and we want to continue giving them this kind of sense of progression and time passing. You know, that, for example, the negotiations of Versailles, they moved on for months. And in the meantime, the lives of the people still went on. And, you know, the expectations changed. And that kind of messy, chaotic situation, that's also history. And we want to show that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Flo. That's all the time we have. Any parting words before we go?
It was my pleasure. And I hope people will continue watching the show, and, you know, if they have any questions for me or for the team and everything, we're reading the comments, we're on Facebook and everything. We still think the community is super important for our project, and happy binge watching for anyone who finds the project now.